This is 89.9 WWNO. Yes, we're headed for another art-filled week. Are you making plans? Or do you need some ideas? Well, you've come to the right place. Whether you're in the mood for a thought-provoking evening of theater, a brass band experience, or a tour of the state's largest recording studio, it's all in the mixed media. Come along as we go inside the arts. Hi, I'm your host, Diane Mack. The NOLA Project's latest theatrical production, A Truckload of Ink, hits especially close to home. The story, an original work by local playwright Jim Fitzmaurice, hones in on the most massive change to hit New Orleans newspapers. Joining me now is playwright Jim Fitzmaurice and NOLA Project Artistic Director and actor A.J. Allegra. Welcome to Inside the Arts.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
Well, they say art imitates life, and you have gone to the heart of a real-life issue that polarized our community when the city's most established newspaper made some unexpected changes in personnel and in how readers got their news. Tell us, beginning with you, AJ, how this project came about.
I was on vacation last summer overseas when I started checking my Facebook and Twitter feeds in the hotel room in Italy, and I was seeing this explosion of information about Times-Picayune all of a sudden reducing its publications to 3 days a week, and the likely results being that a large portion of the staff was going to be laid off. Kevin Allman was reporting it heavily on Gambit's Twitter, and the New York Times was reporting it. The odd thing was that the Times-Picayune itself didn't seem to be reporting it. So I was following all these sources, and it suddenly became a very big portion of my day. I was, you know, obsessively checking in on this developing news story. And immediately when I got back home, after reading about not only the decision, but the kind of dramatics behind the decision, the stories of Crown Royal being brought to the newsroom as people, you know, were offering condolences to one another, the story of the Wits Inn trip where the Chicago Tribune paid for everyone's bar tab the night of the announcement. And it all just struck me as very theatrical. And I thought, there's something here at the core of this that makes a really great play. Because there's two really good ideas, and they're head-to-head against each other. And that's the future of journalism, is do we fight for a tradition because it is a tradition, or do we move forward and tell our news in the media and the digital age that we're in on our tablets, on our phones? Do we need a paper anymore, or is the paper just something that we're holding on to because it's something that's precious to us as an institution, as a tradition? So I called Jim Fitzmaurice, and I said, Jim, we've got something here. Let's go out for a coffee.
I was actually thrilled because in a lot of ways, a newspaper, given all the people that make up the staff of a newspaper, whether it's an environmental hospital reporter, city hall reporters, human interest, people who just cover, you know, gardening, which you really have. And Arthur Miller said it too. He said that a newspaper is a country having a conversation with itself. And I think on the micro, it's a city having a conversation with itself. So when AJ came to me to talk about possibly putting this play together, I was really excited about the possibility because I felt that the NOLA Project would actually get a chance to also have a signature piece, the idea that their ensemble would be able to create the ensemble of a newsroom. AJ brought up a good point, too, that there's a conversation that wasn't happening in all of this. People were so concerned about the piece of paper on their front doorstep. They were so concerned about, you know, whether they got that piece of paper Monday through Sunday. They weren't thinking about the fact that what you're really losing isn't the paper. What you're losing is the staff that can possibly investigate all the things that are going on in your city.
So what would you say were the challenges for you in writing this work?
14 people. And we have 14 people on stage. It's the biggest cast that I've ever put on a stage. And one of the things that we talked about early was that it had to be an ensemble piece. I mean, there are examples, particularly from the 19th century, but also recently, where you have shows with big casts, but where it's all kind of dependent upon one sort of titanic character at the center. What you have to do, because you've got two concerns. One, you want to create the fabric and landscape of the daily existence of a newspaper. More importantly, you've got 14 people in a show, and each one of them has to have a moment to shine, while at the same time controlling the narrative and keeping it clear. And it ends up being like a jazz piece where they're all playing the same song, but every once in a while somebody stands up and gets a solo.
And who are the stars that get these solos in this production, AJ?
We have Bob Eades Jr., who plays the retiring Irish reporter that kind of starts off the show with a bang. We have Leslie Castay, who plays the society columnist. We have Tracy Collins, who plays the euphemistic efficiency expert that has been brought in to determine who goes and who stays. One of the most interesting pieces of casting, Martin Covert, who worked at the Times-Picayune for 32 years, I believe. He is playing the editor-in-chief of our fictionalized New Orleans newspaper. And then we have a lot of the NOLA Project regulars. Myself, I'm playing a political columnist, and that doesn't even cover the entirety. It's a 14-person cast, and everyone gets their piece of candy.
Now, one of the stars in this production is UNO's theater director, David Hoover, and I believe you have a little sample that you can share with us. Can you set it up for me?
Absolutely. David Hoover plays Abe Gannon, who is the Metro Desk editor. And what has happened in the show is the efficiency expert has come in, and of course some people are going to be offered buyouts and some people are going to try to keep their job. I won't give any too much away, but Abe Gannon has basically made a stand against the efficiency expert and is making a strong point using a piece of technology that he's going to destroy. So this clip that we have comes right after that technology has been openly destroyed in the middle of the newsroom, and Abe is making a very strong point to Aiden, which is played by Tracy Collins, the efficiency expert.
You see that? That's the problem! We're not telling the stories of the world around us. We're telling the stories that are in our inboxes. We're a newspaper, people. A narrative for a city. We are not an analog site for your blogs. I don't know how you people do it.
What is your ultimate goal with this production?
I don't think that this play is the solution to the newspaper problem, but I do think that it is a very effective way to let the community have a shared experience and feel like they are represented in whatever side of the argument that they take. It's not our first original show, but it's probably our most prominent original show in that it deals just so intensely with a local issue that is moving national. This is a play that I feel like starts in New Orleans and finishes on a national scale. We really hope that the play doesn't start and end here, but is performed at other theaters. We've invited artistic directors from all other portions of the country that are having the same type of newspaper problems that we're having right now.
And for you, Jim?
On a personal level, I hope I've created a signature piece for the company. I know a lot of people aren't able to kind of put into words what it is they're worried about in terms of New Orleans and the affairs of our state, because the play, as AJ said, starts here and then ends larger. It also starts with newspapers, but begins to move out into education because, you know, anyone who knows anything about what's been going on at the universities and the state universities with cuts, anyone who knows what's been going on in the hospital sector in regards to cuts and the privatization of the state to a large degree, it becomes a kind of a larger statement, and that then spreads out that if you notice the places where the newspaper problems are happening, you're also seeing the private sector being invited in by certain governmental entities to take over more and more things, and that is not always for the best. I mean, there's a line where the public trust is a great business model, provided you don't abuse the public trust.
Gentlemen, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
We were talking with playwright Jim Fitzmaurice and NOLA Project artistic director and actor A.J. Allegra. A Truckload of Ink opens tomorrow night at 7:30 with a preview performance at the Robert E. Nims Theater in the UNO Performing Arts Center. Shows run through September 21st. You're listening to Inside the Arts on 89.9 WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio. I'm Diane Mack. New Orleans thinks of brass band music as its own, that unmistakable mix of live horns and percussion, not to mention the traditional brass band songs. But a 20-piece brass band from Rhode Island swept through town recently, with Balkan, Klezmer, and Bollywood thrown in the mix. Lane Kaplan-Levinson caught up with these Providence musicians in New Orleans, which they call their sister city.
Approaching the Always Lounge on St. Claude Avenue, I could hear the music from across the street. The very loud music. You're hearing six trumpets, six trombones, and six in the percussion of the What Cheer Brigade. And that's only those who were able to come on tour. Walking inside, I saw shiny reflective horns spilling over the slightly elevated stage onto the floor, rubbing shoulders with the crowd as the band opened the show. It's hard to define what type of music the What Cheer Brigade plays without listing most genres known to man. This rambunctious blend of brass is a workout for everyone in the room, whether you're jumping up and down like you're at a metal show or kneeling to the ground like you're in a Greenwich Village coffee shop. But why are there so many of them? Dan plays sousaphone for What Cheer and says it's all volume.
It's the legacy we've inherited from like the noise scene in Providence. And so if you are a band that is completely acoustic and you want to be really loud, you need a lot of people.
CJ plays the cymbals and is the band's newest member. She says it's the party factor.
I think it was Athens, Georgia, where we showed up to a house party and I thought it was like really bumping inside. I was like, all right, this is going to be really great. And I go inside and it's just us. It's like three other people.
Naturally, they love New Orleans. For the past 8 years, the group has been coming down to play gigs in March and Mardi Gras parades and discovered that this city has a lot in common with their hometown of Providence, Rhode Island, especially the people in them, says percussionist Chop Chop the Chimp.
The people we know in both cities seem to really possess this do-it-yourself attitude, finding a place where they can afford to do it yourself, finding a place where there aren't the hindrances you might have in other places just to make what you want to happen happen.
But the music scenes are really different, says trumpeter Nick Horton.
In New Orleans, obviously, there's years and years of appreciation of brass music, and you guys are blessed for having that. And we, unfortunately, don't have that in Providence. You know, the high schools don't bring people up playing brass music. There's not that same sort of tradition and marching bands or anything like that. But people still love it.
And people love What Cheer's own traditions. Their game day slash warrior face paint, the frenetic intensity they bring to every show, and their party tricks. Like bass drummer Norlin's newest trick, playing his drum while standing on it, crowd surfing. I saw this.
It makes you sort of bring your A game because you don't want to show up to New Orleans playing songs that carry the tradition of like New Orleans horn players and do them sloppy or bad. So it sort of, you know, it puts you on your toes in this good way where, like, you know, it puts a little bit of pressure on you.
In most towns they visit, the New Orleans songs are the crowd favorites. But here they avoid the standards, not just because they don't want to mess them up, Dan says, but because their role here is to bring a different kind of brass.
When we're in a place like Columbia, South Carolina, yeah, we played like all of our New Orleans songs in that set because people there are going to associate the sonic palette that we have with that style of music more and be more ready to hear it. When we're here, it's funny, we have this more built-in audience of people who are ready to go on like this whole other journey with us.
With no second lines or jazz funerals, What Cheer creates its own cause for an occasion. This is part of a new trend of activist street bands that support protests and community organizing. Chop Chop the Chimp recalls the band's beginnings.
We started partly from a true love of Balkan brass music and a true fascination with bands like Extra Action, which was one of the earlier brass bands out there doing that sort of no-holds-bar, we've got unplugged instruments so we can go where we want sort of situation.
Chop says it's not having the history of brass music that allows for this interpretive freedom.
There is no place where someone in Providence says, we need a brass band for this. So instead, we just said, hey, we're a brass band. This is the type of music we love to do. This is the sort of environment we want to create, and we just do it.
It's actually happening here, too. Local bands like Panorama Brass Band, Why Are We Building Such a Big Ship, Tuba Skinny, and Sweet Street Symphony are taking the history of New Orleans brass and making it something new, with Eastern European and Afro-Brazilian beats, and then in the blink of an eye leading straight into St. James Infirmary proper. which What Cheer can play too. They just don't do it here. For WWNO, I'm Lane Kaplan-Levenson.
To see pictures and videos of the What Cheer Brigade in action, go to WWNO.org or NOLAV.com. While local film production has exploded and Hollywood has infiltrated the city, post-production, specifically sound production, has lagged. But in WWNO's Take 5 series, Brian Friedman takes a tour of what is now the largest recording studio in the state. This new facility may change the game when it comes to audio for big-time film projects.
The first thing you notice when you enter the control room at Esplanade Studios is the mixing board. Thousands of dials, buttons, and gauges line a surface about the size of a canoe. And not surprisingly, this board has some history. The Trident TSM console, built in the 1970s, once resided at A&M Studios in Los Angeles and Prairie Sound Recording in the Bay Area, and was used to record artists like Barbra Streisand, The Police, Tom Waits, and the best-selling single of all time, We Are the World.
So this board has seen lots of great music, and you'll see again. Hopefully more.
That's Misha Kashishvili, owner and chief engineer of Esplanade Studios. From 1921 until the Sunday before Hurricane Katrina, the Gothic Revival Church on Esplanade Avenue in the Treme was home to the Third Presbyterian congregation. Then the storm hit, flooding the building, shattering its windows, and scattering its congregation, forcing them to sell. The church then sat on the market for 5 years, vacant and decaying. Enter Misha, a native of the Republic of Georgia, who first came to America in 1994 as part of an exchange between Loyola University and the Georgian Conservatory.
Going to Loyola and meeting all these jazz cats and professors, and just, that was it. It was my dream place to be.
And so he stayed and began his career as a sound engineer for local musicians. Misha worked at Access Studios in Metairie, but was searching for a place of his own. Turns out the answer was hiding in plain sight.
I lived literally one block away. Then when I saw the first place, I was overwhelmed. There was a water in a basement still, and floors were gone in by termites. There was just roof was gone. But I felt such a good vibe. As soon as I walked in, it just, building felt great. So that was a decisive factor for me.
So with the state's film tax credit program at his back, Misha bought the property and immediately got to work.
This is the second level.
He showed me around the new space.
This will be a Studio B, and actually tenants are moving in tomorrow. The guy's name is Danny Markowitz. He's a composer, songwriter, producer. He's known for writing the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing. He wrote that song. So Danny will be...
Studio C is a private studio for film and television composer Jay Weigel, who's fresh off creating music for Will Ferrell's recent The Campaign, as well as for Tyler Perry's Madea movies.
Esplanade Studios is the first studio complex in the state that I'm aware of that actually built something that's different than anybody else had. It actually filled a niche.
That's Jay.
It's a big enough space that you can actually do sort of the kind of recordings that are normally only done in major cities like Los Angeles. And I don't even know if you can do this in New York anymore, quite honestly. I'm not sure if they have a space anymore. So this is really remarkable that Misha pulled this together.
Studio A, the 3,400-square-foot main recording room at the heart of the church's former sanctuary, is dominated by a massive pipe organ donated by Andrew Carnegie in the 1920s. It's one of just two the philanthropist gave to the city.
One is still on North Rampart Street, one of the churches. I don't know the condition of it, but so this is the sister organ that ended up somehow in this church. So now it's part of the Esplanade Studios. It's not functioning right now, but I'm working on it. One day I'll bring it back.
Still under construction is an additional 3,000-square-foot downstairs space for special recording projects, including live or private concerts with the church's original pews for seating.
So, and that will be jazz bands and folk groups or something that's not like a big and loud. You know?
Local musicians stand to benefit from the increased opportunities offered by Esplanade. But it's the classical musicians, those most vulnerable in a city dominated by jazz and funk, who are really in luck.
It's important to keep those players here. They're phenomenal players, and they're from all around the country. And having for them the space that can guarantee them some work and just keep everything going, it's very, very important.
For Weigel, Esplanade's significance hits closer to home.
I mean, I'm fine. I can write and do my thing. But I have children, and I want them, if they're going to be in New Orleans and are interested, and I don't know if they are, in the music industry, I want them to have something to do. And this, we're building something. It's very exciting.
The local film industry currently outsources most of its audio post-production work. It'll be interesting to see whether the new Esplanade Studios changes that. For WWNO, I'm Brian Friedman.
You're listening to the Louisiana Philharmonic playing an excerpt from the final movement of Mozart's Symphony No. 36. Brian Friedman's coverage of Hollywood South is brought to you in partnership with NOLA V and is made possible with the assistance of the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. And we have something extra in our Lanyap Corner. Jazz in the Park launches its fourth season in Armstrong Park, running 9 weeks this fall, beginning Thursday with Mia Borders at 5 p.m., followed by the Stooges Brass Band at 6:30. You'll also find arts and crafts and second lines as part of the Jazz in the Park experience in Armstrong Park. The hours of Jazz in the Park are now noon to 8 p.m. with the Treme Nights After Party happening at Kermit Ruffin's Treme Speakeasy from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Kermit Ruffins will lead a second line to his place every week after the close of the show. The Anthony Bean Community Theater presents Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award winner August Wilson's first Broadway hit, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, opening Friday with performances running weekends through September 29th. The Anthony Bean Community Theater is located at 1333 South Carrollton Avenue, corner of Willow Street. And music scholar and pianist Dr. William Kinderman, heralded as the world's foremost authority on Ludwig van Beethoven's Diabelli Variations, will visit Loyola University New Orleans to perform Beethoven's masterpiece on Thursday, September 12th, 7:30 p.m. in Roussel Performance Hall, located in Loyola's Communications Music Complex on the corner of St. Charles Avenue and Calhoun Street. The event is free and open to the public. That's our show for this week. Inside the Arts is a production of WWNO. Our program is archived at WWNO.org. I'll be back with more ideas for your artistic palette next Tuesday at 1 p.m. when we'll go Inside the Arts. I'm Diane Mack.